Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we'll explore the Wild West of California's drug rehab industry. Drug addiction rates have skyrocketed over the last decade, and an estimated 2 million Americans are now addicted to opioids alone. As the epidemic has worsened, the demand for addiction treatment has grown. But not all treatment facilities are providing quality care. And furthermore, unscrupulous facility operators and their patient brokers are exploiting both patients and insurance companies. This lack of regulation can have fatal consequences. In one investigation conducted by the Southern California News Group, they found that one death occurs approximately every 2 weeks in treatment centers in Southern California. So tonight we'll ask, how have loose regulation, predatory practices, and insurance fraud led to major profits for some addiction treatment centers? Are new state laws sufficient to impose order on the rehab industry? And how do Californians find reputable, responsible treatment providers? Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues is Dr. David Kahn. He's an addiction psychiatrist and the chief medical officer of Bright Heart Health, a telemedicine addiction treatment program. He's also the current president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine, or CSAM, the state's chapter of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Welcome, Dr. David Kahn.
Thank you, Joseph.
And joining us by phone, we have two guests. First, Dr. Marvin Sapala, Chief Medical Officer at Hazleton Betty Ford, the nation's largest nonprofit addiction treatment provider. Dr. Sapala is also an adjunct assistant professor at the Hazleton Betty Ford Graduate School of Addiction Studies, a board member of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and the author of several books, including Prescription Painkillers, History, Pharmacology, and Treatment, and The Clinician's Guide to 12-Step Principles. Welcome, Dr. Marvin Sapala.
Thank you very much. Glad to be involved.
And finally, I'm happy to welcome back Dr. Anna Lemke, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine, where she also serves as Medical Director of Addiction Medicine. Dr. Lemke is the author of the best-selling book, Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop, which explores the complex relationship between doctors and patients around prescribing controlled drugs. Welcome back, Dr. Lemke.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. So Dr. Anna Lemke of Stanford, I wanted to start with you just so our listeners can get a sense of what is going on out there. Tell us a little bit about the state of substance use in California. What do we know about who is using and what they're using and what kind of consequences are occurring because of that use?
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, the problem of addiction has been endemic in human societies since the beginning of time. But what we have seen in recent decades is rising rates of addiction. Most notably, we've seen that we're in the midst of an opioid epidemic, more and more individuals getting hooked on opioids and dying therefrom. So that's a major tragedy, and California hasn't been spared. But I always like to point out that although, you know, the nation is sort of just coming to grips in many ways with this opioid epidemic, we actually have good treatments, and we've known about them for quite a long time. And so this kind of, there's sort of a hopelessness that people, you know, get in their minds when they think about addiction. Addiction is a complicated illness. The treatment is, you know, not a simple, you know, one-size-fits-all kind of a thing, but we have good treatments, and the treatments work, and they work on par with other treatments for other chronic relapsing and remitting illnesses. There's about a 50% response rate sort of for all evidence-based treatments, which is on par with treatments for other chronic relapsing and remitting disorders like depression, like type 2 diabetes.
So you're saying that this is both not a new thing to have people in society that are hooked on or addicted to substances, but that there's been good treatment out there for quite some time. So tell us about then, as we pivot to the focus of tonight's show, which is about the drug rehab industry in California. What does that look like to you when you take a broad view of it?
Well, you know, the drug treatment industry is sort of all over the map, which is kind of the problem. There are very, very good facilities that do great work, and there are very, very bad facilities that are dangerous. And so, you know, one of the major focuses of folks in the field of addiction medicine is to try to regulate the facilities, to define what constitutes good treatment and make sure that every facility meets some kind of, you know, minimum threshold criteria. And importantly, bring addiction treatment into the house of medicine. What we have now is there's sort of like, you know, mainstream medical care, and then outside of it is treatment for addiction, and often somewhere else entirely treatment for mental health. And what we really need to do is kind of bring all of those silos under one roof so that patients can get their medical care and their addiction treatment and their mental health treatment roughly all in the same place. We'll still have specialists. Not everybody's going to be a specialist in addiction treatment. But right now it's just a giant scramble. And, you know, tragically, people don't know where to go to find a good treatment. And so that's really what we have to change. We have to kind of regulate it and organize it and have minimum standards.
So where and how did these silos get created?
Well, they got created because of long-term stigma. For more than 200 years since Benjamin Rush, there have been people inside and outside of medicine saying, hey, addiction is disease. We should treat it like a disease. But the medical community has really resisted that. So in order to fill the vacuum, we've had all these different actors outside of medicine, trying to provide care, which is understandable because people are desperate for treatment. So as a result, it's sort of this, you know, entrepreneurial catch-as-catch-can, you never quite know what you're getting, situation. And that's sort of the state, that's the state of the art right now, and that's what we need to change.
And is that already changing, or has that already been changing? Breaking down those silos?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of, as bad as things are, and of course, you know, my heart goes out to all the people out there who have tried to get care and couldn't, who have been recipients of bad care. But really the good news, there's lots to celebrate here, and that is that medicine has really begun to recognize that addiction is an illness. In surveys of Americans, if you ask them, you know, like multiple choice question, is addiction an illness or is it, you know, a problem of moral torpitude or lack of willpower, the majority of Americans, more than two-thirds of Americans, will now say addiction is an illness. We've got more and more people interested in it. I mean, 10 years ago, I could not peel a medical student off the pavement to come and rotate in my clinic, and now they're banging down my door. So there's a lot to celebrate here in terms of, you know, medicine recognizing addiction as an illness, and a lot of initiative and energy around wanting to provide better care for this vulnerable population.
And so what I'm hearing here is that the standard of care is shifting in your view, that it should be more medical model to it. And then alongside that, there's this unregulated industry of rehab providers, of drug rehab providers. Can you talk to us about how those two intersect?
Well, I mean, you summarized it beautifully, right? So the direction that we need to move in is that we need to treat addiction like an illness, and we have medical treatments, and we need to make sure that people have access to that. At the same time, we need to, if people hold themselves out as treating the disease of addiction, then we need to make sure that there are certain standards, and we need to make sure that there's a medical model. So a lot of rehab facilities, for example, who even knows what that word rehab, I mean, that's like an Amy Winehouse term, right? Like rehab, it's almost become a joke in modern culture. We really need to medicalize the language, and we need to medicalize, you know, these residential treatment facilities where people go to get care. Even just simple things like making sure there's actually a physician on site or available to the patients to go there. Many, many treatment facilities don't even have an affiliation, you know, with a healthcare provider, which is not the standard of care. So as we move toward a medicalized model, we've got to make sure that any establishment that says they provide addiction treatment really provides the evidence-based treatment that is available. And here's a really important piece. It's going to be a different combination of treatments for every single person. So the standard of care should be that at any facility, that individual has access to all of the different evidence-based treatments, right? So it can't be that, well, you have to do this because this is what we have. No, I mean, they should have buprenorphine, they should have methadone, they should have naltrexone, they should have, you know, certain types of psychotherapeutic interventions, there should be access to 12-step, which is an evidence-based intervention. All of those should be available because every single person is going to kind of put together a different combination of treatments in order to get better. Lots of different ways to the top of the mountain.
And so what exists if it's not a medical treatment? What is the type of treatment that people are receiving in rehab centers that don't have a medical connection or a medical practice associated with them?
Well, you know, there's a wide range. So there are very good treatment facilities that are heavily based on 12-step models. 12-step is a shorthand for saying Alcoholics Anonymous is the founding 12-step group. You know, there's a lot of AA bashing that goes on now in popular culture and out there in the media. But the truth is that although AA is not a medical treatment, it's a very effective intervention for those who actively participate. The problem is that for almost 100 years, it's been almost the only thing available, and that's not okay because not everybody is going to do well with that 12-step model. We have some excellent treatment centers out there that only offer 12-step, and for example, we'll have patients who are on buprenorphine Suboxone, which is opioid agonist treatment for opioid use disorder, who need to go into a residential treatment because of a relapse, and they're told they have to get off of that buprenorphine before they can go in. That's not acceptable. That's not the standard of care. We need these very excellent 12-step based treatment programs to also use tools like medication-assisted treatment. So, and I think that's easier to change than the other sort of glaring problem is there are other residential treatment facilities that are just plain old awful. I mean, they're not good. There's no good care there. They're not regulated. They're not licensed. People go there, and there's not good recovery, and they pay money. And, I mean, there are places that are just overtly, you know, preying on people with addiction, and those places need to be shut down.
So to draw a distinction there, and then I'm going to bring Dr. Sepla into the conversation, what you're saying is there's a new standard of care that, or maybe not so new standard of care, or a standard of care that's been around for a while that needs to be embraced by these 12-step model programs that are also known as abstinence-only programs. And we can talk about the evidence, Dr. Sepla, about why that is and why that, that in your view, and I imagine the view of most of our panelists tonight, if not all of them, that's the way to go. And that's one thing. And then there's the unscrupulous treatment centers. And so I want to make sure that I didn't hear in what you were just saying, but just in case someone thinks that you're conflating the two there, Dr. Lemke, that there's the 12-step model alone versus 12-step plus medication-assisted treatment. And then there's the problem also of unregulated and unscrupulous treatment centers.
Yes, you said it better than I did. That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Because so, I could imagine the phones ringing and people saying, you're trying to discredit 12-step models,
yeah,
or you're trying to medicalize rehab treatment and kick out a tradition that a lot of people have felt very strongly about.
Yeah, no, thank you for making sure that I'm expressing myself clearly. What I'm trying to say is that the 12-step model is a great model for a great many people, but it's not for everybody. So we need to make sure that when people go to a treatment facility, they have access to all the different types of evidence-based treatments that are available, and that these abstinence-oriented treatment facilities also begin to incorporate some of the newer tools. That's a separate and different problem from the just plain old unscrupulous practices, you know, bad treatment that's out there, and those places need to be closed down. Is that clear?
Yeah, that sounds pretty clear, because it'll help us direct the conversation for the rest of the hour, because Dr. David Kahn is here to talk a lot about policy work in regulating the rehab industry. So I wanted to make sure to set that up that way. But before we get to that, I want to bring Dr. Marvin Sepla into the conversation, Chief Medical Officer at Hazelden Betty Ford, the nation's largest nonprofit addiction treatment provider. And my understanding, Dr. Sepla, is that Hazelden Betty Ford embraced the medication assisted treatment model. It wasn't always that way. Tell us how the organization came to that. What evidence did it look at to bring medication or medically assisted therapies into treatment centers?
I'm glad to. You know, Hazelden Betty Ford started in 1949 when you couldn't find any medical treatment for addiction. No detox for even alcohol was available at that time. And they realized in Minnesota, where it started, that some people were actually getting sober attending AA meetings. And so there were three programs in Minnesota that took that to task and decided, the city of Minneapolis actually funded a little treatment center on Medicine Lake out in Plymouth, a suburb of Minneapolis, Plymouth, where they used a 12-step orientation beginning in the 1940s to address alcoholism, because some of the people on relief were no longer showing up. They actually got sober and were taking care of their own finances and their families. Hazelden took it another step and brought on lay counselors from the AA community, or one lay counselor at the beginning, actually. So we really established that model. And yet, over the years, we have stuck with the evidence. You know, we've relied on the science. We've relied on medicine, even though we started before medicine was even interested in addressing addiction. And more recently, with a full recognition of the benefit of medications for alcohol use disorders that was established, we started using those medications very early on. And more recently, really had to do the same thing for opioid use disorders. And it's just in keeping with how we've done things all along. We've treated women since 1956, which seems odd to say, you know, at this day and age, but back then it seemed very unusual to do so, and really was stepping out, so to speak. We've had mental health services since the early 60s, and that's not even common in a lot of the types of treatment programs that you're referencing, these unscrupulous programs that really don't provide the care necessary. And as Dr. Lemke said, every individual needs their own kind of personalized treatment plan specific to what's going on in their life. We seldom see anybody come into our settings with a single use disorder, like an opioid use disorder plus alcohol plus marijuana plus some methamphetamine might be a common sort of thing, in addition to PTSD, a depressive disorder, and an anxiety disorder. So these are really complex folks that need all the services to, in an integrated fashion, to address the multitude of problems that they're addressing. And that doesn't even speak to the family issues, social issues, job and legal issues that are probably going on as well.
So tell us a little bit about the evidence that, if you look at the effectiveness of medically assisted treatments versus 12-step, how do they compare? Have there been studies that look at those things head-to-head, so to speak?
You know, I don't know that they've been compared against one another. At this point in time, the federal government, under the National Institute of Health, primarily National Institute of Drug Abuse, is recommending the use of medications in the treatment of opioid use disorders, primarily because the data has shown a reduction in death rate and improved abstinence rates. And that's pretty clear cut, and we need to take that into account, and anyone that comes into our setting with an opioid use disorder is recommended to be on one of the medications for that condition. In addition to using a 12-step orientation and psychotherapies and peer support, so our basic program is we use medications, we use psychotherapy, we use peer support. It's all evidence-based, it's all really sound, and the suggestion is that if you don't use medications for opioid use disorders, more people will likely die. Now, we have recently submitted a study that we completed in our setting looking at opioid use disorders and two medications, buprenorphine naloxone, commonly referred to as Suboxone, as well as extended-release naltrexone, a once-a-month injection. And we had a naturalistic study. They ended up with three groups because some people refuse medications. They come into our setting and they absolutely will not take a medication, even though we offer it to every person with an opioid use disorder and consistently try and convince them it could be beneficial. And yet, in the end, when you put together a really robust psychosocial treatment with psychotherapies, with peer support, with a long-term outpatient approach, you end up with pretty darn good recovery rates over time, and that's what we found, actually, that we couldn't differentiate statistically between those on the two medications and those without medication. So there's a lot of information that we don't have in this field. It's a relatively new field in regard to the medical aspects of it, the research associated with it, and coming to understand this field is going to change dramatically in the next 10 years or so, because now there's finally real attention in medicine and in the medical research to address our patients.
So I want to bring Dr. David Kahn into the conversation as well, addiction psychiatrist and chief medical officer of Bright Heart Health, a telemedicine addiction treatment program, and the current president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine. Dr. Kahn, what evidence is out there that helps us understand and support the argument that Dr. Lemke was making at the beginning of the program, that really bringing medication and medication-assisted treatment into rehab as a standard of care is necessary? It sounds like Hazleton, Betty Ford, has adopted that model for a while, but their own study that doesn't necessarily support that model. I don't want to necessarily misinterpret what Dr. Sepla said, but he said they didn't see differences. So is there evidence that shows that medically assisted treatment is actually better than 12-step?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So as far as Dr. Sepla's study, I'd love to see a copy of it once it's published, and happy to look at it beforehand, because I think Hazleton Betty Ford is a outlier insofar as they provide the very best psychosocial treatment. But if I look at the data, looking specifically at opioid use disorder, medications account for about 80% of the benefit, meaning that a medication alone will get you 80% of the benefit in reducing risky drug use, reducing the risk of accidental overdose as well as fatal overdose, and it'll improve retention in treatment. So when we talk about retention and treatment, this is one of the metrics that we all agree on, is that treatment for addiction is not like penicillin for pneumonia. It's not like a one-shot deal. And when they sell you the idea of a 28 or 30-day program, it's an attractive idea. But what we know is that addiction is a disorder that has multiple impacts, and you have to work on all those impacts. One of the things that I like to say that is as what's critical in planning care is a thorough and good assessment, not only of the addiction, but of the person's strengths, their areas in which they need to improve, what is their family support situation, and what has and has not worked in the past. Because when it comes to addiction treatment, it often takes multiple attempts at treatment before somebody achieves lasting abstinence or they achieve the recovery that they want to achieve.
So what I'm hearing from all three of you is that an individualized, holistic approach is what is necessary, and that's not that's not what's out there and in the mainstream necessarily. And so we're going to turn to that as the program unfolds, to really understand kind of what's out there, and then how do we what are the roles of government and the medical community and others to figure out how to get to this standard that the three of you are supporting, and also advice for people who might be looking for treatment, and how they decide what's the best place for them and what's a place that's going to be providing them state-of-the-art and competent care. But first, I want to put out the phone number in case you want to join our conversation here. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing California's loosely regulated drug rehab industry with our guests, Dr. David Kahn, addiction psychiatrist, current president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine and chief medical officer of Bright Heart Health, Dr. Anna Lemke, medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine, and Dr. Marvin Sepla, chief Medical Officer at Hazelden Betty Ford. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, tweet us, or post a comment on our Facebook page. What is your opinion of California's drug rehab industry? Have you had personal experience with it, with a family member, for example? 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. So we have an email here from Leanne, and I'm going to be doing a little paraphrasing here, and that that the actual success rates in 12-step programs hover around an abysmal 10%. She says, the problem with 12-step is that while it is wonderful for supporting the psychosocial needs of the patient, it does not address the abnormalities in the addicted brain or of the addicted brain, often permanently altered and needs to be addressed often first. So tell us more, Dr. Khan. How do you see the medication and the psychosocial treatment really working together? Because I don't think anyone is saying that it's one or the other, right?
Right. I would say that it's a false dichotomy to say that it's one or the other. If I think about the addiction, so for example, with opioid addiction, opioid use disorder, 80% of the benefit is in the medications. If I think about alcohol or tobacco, about 50% of the benefit is in medications alone. And if I think about drugs such as cocaine or methamphetamine, the stimulants, maybe 5% of the variance is attributable to medications. So part of it is you have to think, in part of doing a medical assessment, you have to think about what addiction are we trying to treat. Oftentimes it's multiple comorbid addictions, and one medication may be good for multiple addictions. If I think about 12-step programs, the person who probably has done the best research on 12-step programs is researcher Lee Kaskoudis in Emeryville, the Alcohol Research Group. And what she's demonstrated with 12-step is a lot of people go to 12-step and they don't stick. But for the people who stick, 12-step looks a lot like medication. There's a dose response curve, meaning the more that people participate, whether they actually go to meetings, they have a sponsor, they take on a sponsorship relationship, there's a linear dose response curve in which people participate. And medications account for some part of the effect size, but you can make that up in working a robust 12-step program. As an addiction psychiatrist, I love 12-step. I recommend it to all of my patients. But if my patients say no to 12-step, I take that no as a no. I try to explore what their concerns are, and I explain it to them just like a medication. It's got a dose response curve. There are people who do better in 12-step programs. So, for example, people with more severe addictions as well as more severe comorbid mental health problems. These are actually the people who do the very best in 12-step programs, which most people don't understand.
Yeah, that sounds a little counterintuitive, actually.
Right. Mm. And that's what happens when you get to the research, is you find things that actually surprise you. And so 12-step programs, it's a yes and, not a one or the other.
Dr. Anna Lemke, do you want to add there?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think it's unfortunate that 12-steps is getting so much negative press now, because it's really one of the most remarkable social movements in the last 100 years. And, you know, as David said, for those who actively engage and participate, the recovery rates are really remarkable. What 12-step also offers above and beyond almost any other treatment that you can come up with is that it's free. And it's available in every church basement all over the world. And that's huge, because we have very serious, you know, access problems. There's so much churn in our medical system that, you know, let's say you find a treatment provider and you're doing better, but then your work changes or you lose your job or that provider moves away or your insurance changes, you know, all of a sudden you have to start over. And 12-step is a way that people weave recovery into their everyday lives, and their recovery is really robust. So although I'm absolutely in agreement with David Kahn, it's not an either or. It's like doing what works for you. I really want people out there to understand that, for those who actively participate in 12 steps, it's a really great intervention. And a lot of people do medications and 12 steps, and more and more 12-step groups are accepting of medications. there's a lot less stigma than there used to be. So again, it's this idea that every person should have access to all of the different treatments and interventions, because what's going to work for one person is not going to be the same as what's going to work for another person.
So medication is what really stabilizes people, and then it sounds like 12 steps can be one of the ways that people kind of knit their life back together.
Well, I love the metaphor of knitting life back together, but I wouldn't say that people first get stabilized on medication. Mm-hmm. Some people don't do well on medication at all. You know, they try this and they try that and nothing works, and, you know, they're not in recovery, and the thing that really works for them is 12-step. Other people will try 12-step again and again, and they don't get into recovery, and then one day they get prescribed naltrexone, or they get prescribed, you know, acamprosate or Vivitrol or Chantix or who knows what it is, and that was, you know, the key in the lock for them. For most people, it's actually a combination. It's a little bit of this, it's a little bit of that. It's kind of all these different nudges. You know, it's really important to remember that addiction is a complex biopsychosocial disease, which means that it needs a biological intervention, a psychological intervention, and a social intervention for most people to really attain robust recovery.
All right. So
let's just clarify one thing.
Yes.
About 12-step programs, that they are not treatment. So it's somewhat unfair to compare a 12-step program to a treatment program, because they're more like a disease management program, much like what Dr. Lemke is describing, the long-term management to help people remain abstinent. In some respects, I think it was George Valiant, Harvard psychiatrist, suggested they are programs that help people avoid using substances for the long term, you know, so they're relapse prevention programs.
Yeah, the other thing I would add is that there are now also a lot of alternatives to AA and other 12-step programs. So there are things like a Refuge Recovery, which is more of a Buddhist-based mutual help group. There's Moderation Management, which is mainly online, but helps people whose goal is to moderate their use, not necessarily abstain from using. So there's been an explosion also in different types of mutual help groups out there.
All right. So let's go to Jess in San Francisco. Jess, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Okay. What's your question or comment for the panel?
I live across the street from a needle. It's called an exchange, but it's a dispensary. I don't understand why in the year 2019 I have to see a bunch of syringes, orange caps, opaque caps, etc., on the sidewalks. I have to see a couple of guys in blue eyes odd shirts with a little tool that's just a piece of bent metal flicking those orange caps and the clear ones or opaque out of the stress lines in the sidewalk. I don't believe it's right to give junkies a box, and I've been there myself. I don't believe it's right to give them a box of syringes and say, go, be fruitful and multiply.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jess. So this is an issue of, you know, harm reduction, right? Needle exchanges are meant as a harm reduction method. And there's been lots of discussion in the press about, in San Francisco, people seeing a lot of needle debris on the streets. How do we make sense of all of this as we're trying to normalize the experience of addiction as a medical condition?
You know, yeah, David Kahn, what I would respond to that is there's actually a bill going through the assembly right now. It's called AB 362, and it's a bill that would authorize a pilot programs in San Francisco to create safe consumption spaces, also known as safe injection facilities. The language reads as a harm reduction facility. And what is particularly notable about harm reduction facilities is that if I think about harm reduction, I see it as part of the continuum of care. This is about early engagement and meeting people where they're at. And
so these are people who are not interested in treatment.
That's exactly
of the types
right.
we've been talking about.
Right. And I worry much more about the patient who's not in my care than the patient who is in care, because if I'm working with somebody, it's an opportunity to change. If something's not working, we find something else. Whereas safe injection facilities, one of the biggest pieces of evidence is, number one, it prevents fatal overdose. There are 120 programs worldwide, millions of supervised injections, and not a single fatal overdose to date. It significantly decreases discarded needles in public drug use. And it's something that in San Francisco is supported by the mayor, the board of supervisors, the district attorney, the police and the sheriff, and moreover the Chamber of Commerce and the Bureau of Tourism, because they agree that open-air drug use is not good for anybody.
This is Marv Cephaly.
Yes.
Almost everything we do in addiction work is harm reduction. These needle exchange programs are a necessary part of a public health plan. There's just no way around it. Not everyone is seeking treatment, and it's a difficult disease. The brain itself has been altered in a way that tries to continue the use of the drug, not even recognizing the problems associated with it. And as a result, we have to have places that could reduce, you know, the difficulties and the diseases associated with injecting in such a way as to reduce the public health crisis associated with addiction.
Let's go to Ariana next. Ariana from San Francisco, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate the layered dialogue. I'm a psychologist. Did academic research on prisoner reentry and drug addiction. And I really appreciate the fact that you're saying there needs to be a multi-pronged approach, because on one end of the spectrum, when you have people who are indigent and who are unable to work perhaps because of mental illness or because they're veterans, they've had sometimes a very severe history of trauma, and they need to feel like they have some sense of a choice, that they are not being imposed, their choices are not being imposed, they won't last. And then when we look at the prison system where the choices were imposed and the incredible oppression there, you see that there's a lot of violence that is born from those kind of environments. But the other thing I did want to say is about the alienation that whatever one's economic class is, that people who are drug addicts often suffer from, and it behooves us to think about more ways of being inclusive as a form of social healing. There's such gross economic disparity, and people who are drug addicted feel like there's no purpose, there's no meaning behind their anthem, and they just commit suicide by way of drugs. And we are partially responsible, all of us, for that. And that is partially also why it's a spiritual issue and a moral issue for all of us, not just an area where we judge other people because they act compulsive and we think that we ourselves don't have any addictions because we don't look really closely at our behavior.
Well, thanks so much for that perspective that helps us to think about the societal underpinnings of what led fed into people's addictions and what they have to look forward to when or not at the other end of a treatment, the road or the path of treatment. I want to reintroduce the program. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org, it's City Visions. And I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we've been talking about rehabilitation for drug use and drug users here in California. And we're going to pivot our conversation in the next couple of minutes to talking about the treatment centers that are out there and the ones that have gotten the attention of lawmakers because they have unscrupulous practices. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also text us or email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Dr. Lemke, you earlier in the hour you said, you know, there needs to be a move towards an integrated model of care that includes psychosocial supports, an example of which is the 12-step model, and medication-assisted treatment. And then we drew the distinction between that argument or that discussion and that there are some awful treatment centers out there that has nothing to do with sort of philosophical differences in approach. It's just the way that they're organized and what they do. Can you outline for us what are some of the egregious examples out there, not necessarily treatment centers by name, but like what are some of the practices that you would describe as awful?
Well, one of the practices is something that's been called the Florida Shuffle, and this refers to treatment centers in the state of Florida, which essentially prey on people with addiction, What they do is they're not looking to really help people, but they just want to get paid through their insurance. So they basically go out and troll for people with addiction, you know, to come into their treatment center. They kind of give them some modicum of what looks like treatment on paper but isn't real treatment. And then they incentivize those individuals, in some cases, to go out and troll for other people to bring them back into the treatment center. So you get these people cycling through these treatment centers again and again, which is the Florida Shuffle. But there's no good faith effort to really help these people. They're really just, these are centers that are just really looking to make a buck, you know, either by having these desperate individuals pay in cash or have their insurance cover the treatment. One of the sort of corollaries of this is kind of the urine toxicology industry, and some of these centers doing urine tox screens. These are screens where they take your urine to test for blood, and doing them like 5 times a day, you know, which doesn't make any clinical sense, but you know, Medicare reimburses you know, a substantial amount for those laboratory tests. So it's basically this sort of thing where it's just preying on vulnerable people, recognizing there's a huge need for addiction treatment. There's a desperation when people and their families are looking for treatment, you know, willing to pay anything, not knowing how to vet those centers. And that's what we're talking about. And also people dying in these treatment centers, these non-medicalized facilities, where people are coming in and having life-threatening detox. We do know that, for example, when people withdraw from alcohol or from benzodiazepines, they can actually die during that withdrawal process, and it requires, in many instances, complex medical management. And they're going into facilities that are basically, you know, the equivalent of a sort of a rundown hotel. There's no real medication or medical personnel on site.
So you're describing a pretty bleak picture that is, as you said, is taking advantage of people in very desperate situations. What are some of the motivators to have people set up so-called programs like these? What were the drivers for it?
You mean besides money?
But my understanding is that the increase in the number of rehab programs has been only in the last number of years. So what has been the catalyst? Let's put it that way for this growth.
Can I answer?
Yeah,
that
sure, Dr. Khan.
So I think the what we're seeing is third party payment, particularly the Affordable Care Act. And one of the things that we've seen with the Affordable Care Act is that more and more people are getting treatment and not necessarily in these bad rundown programs. More people are getting treatment across the board in evidence-based and appropriate settings. But with the Affordable Care Act, what we're seeing is that people can sign up for these PPO-type plans, so provider organization means that you can get services from anybody. And what they'll do is they'll split the bill between the insurer and the person who's insured, so the patient. And as a result of the Affordable Care Act, what we've heard of stories is in the Rehab Riviera, Southern California, there's these patient brokers who are recruiting people, helping them sign up for insurance. And by signing up for one of the Obamacare plans, the Affordable Care Act plans, they suddenly have access to benefits in which the programs can pump tens of thousands, if not literally hundreds of thousands. And I've heard of cases of over $1 million pumped out of a patient for a 30-day treatment stay. So essentially, I would agree with Anna in that they're following the money.
So it sounds like it was also part of the APA was the parity of reimbursement between mental health and medical.
Yeah.
Is that right? That was one of the catalysts as well?
Yeah, that was the 2008 Mental Health Parity Act. And they're trying to – there's legislation to enforce parity, but the consequences that you're having unscrupulous providers take advantage of that.
This is the unintended consequence.
Right.
I mean, I'm thinking of the title of your book, Dr. Lemke, that includes how doctors got duped. How did insurance companies get duped into paying for these types of treatments? I don't know. Do either of you know?
I think first it's important to establish that the Mental Health Parity and Addictions Equity Act of 2008 was a really good thing. Because what it basically said was, hey, insurance companies can no longer shirk their responsibility in terms of reimbursing for mental health and addictions treatment, which prior to that act they had done, right? The Mental Health Parity Act and Addictions Equity Act said those are illnesses, and Medicare and Blue Shield and Aetna, all of you have to pay for that treatment when patients need that treatment. So that was a good thing. The Affordable Care Act basically said any insurance on the insurance exchange needs to abide by the Mental Health Parity and Addictions Equity Act. Again, basically a good thing. But as you point out, the unintended consequences that all of a sudden you've got people who are desperate for treatment, looking for treatment, and don't know how to compare one treatment facility to another, and neither do the insurance companies. They have no idea how to do that. So they're letting
And why is that? I mean, insurance companies are you know, if you talk about the HMO days, right, which we're kind of back in again, there was a lot of discussion about, like, you know, how HMOs are very clear, like they're only going to cover certain treatments that are, you know, they won't cover experimental treatment. They have to do something that's evidence-based. Why didn't they reach for those similar tools here?
Well, it's a great question. They're doing it now. Let's just say they're doing it now, and that's exactly what's happening around, you know, scorecards and quality measures saying, hey, you know, a decent addiction treatment facility should contain X, Y, and Z. So that is happening now, but, you know, it's sort of, this is brand new that addiction is even recognized as something that insurance companies have to pay for.
Dr. Marvin Sepla, it sounded like you wanted to say something there.
Yes, thank you. So Anna's absolutely right that the insurers are now starting to use that data and their own data about readmission rates and costs and that sort of thing to try and make decisions. But they're really caught in a bind in regard to out-of-network care as well, and that's where another scam takes place, and that a treatment center or one of these online services to find you the right treatment center actually just sends you to their treatment center, and whether you have insurance that they take or not, they prefer that you don't have insurance that they take so that they can use out-of-network care and in that way bill whatever they want to the insurer. We're contracted with almost all the major insurers in the country, and whenever I go in to talk with them about these contracts and that sort of thing, they complain about out-of-network care, and they complain about the lab tests that Dr. Lemke also described. They really know these things are going on. They're trying to address them, but their hands are kind of tied in regard to some of it, because, you know, if you have a policy for your work situation in Portland, Oregon, and you have to travel outside of the state for one reason or another, and you're not near your doctor when something comes up and you're hospitalized, they have to pay for it. They've got to be able to do so out of network for that type of situation, and these unscrupulous treatment programs are taking advantage of it.
All right.
Can I make one last comment?
Go ahead.
I will tell you that working with insurers currently through the company that I work with, many insurers are moving towards a concept known as value-based care. Historically, care has either been capitated, meaning that they'll pay X number of dollars. It's fee-for-service, meaning that you get paid per service. But many insurers are looking at value-based care, meaning that if they send somebody to treatment, they want to demonstrate the value. And I can tell you there's a large data set from an unnamed HMO, which showed that if somebody enters addiction treatment, their health care costs drop by 50%, 50. But what's more interesting is that the family's health care costs also drop by 50%. And hopefully that HMO will publish that data, because it will incentivize more insurance programs to cover the treatment that's needed.
So what we're saying here is let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, in the sense of that mental health parity is important and still really useful. It's just that in this case, it was unscrupulous people who have chosen to, you know, use that, and in the case of PPO payments, out-of-network payments, use the loophole to be able to cash in on this. So staying with you, Dr. David Kahn, there has been some movement at the California state legislature level that is looking to try to regulate these previously unregulated treatment centers. Could you run down some of the things that have been either put into place or being considered?
Yeah, sure. So in the last legislative year, they passed a number of bills that we consider to be advances. The first one that I would think of was a bill that required residential treatment programs to follow the ASAM criteria. ASAM is the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and they have published criteria on what is required at different levels of treatment. And the highest level of treatment is residential treatment, and then it steps down from there. They passed a bill prohibiting patient brokering. So this idea where people can recruit patients into the program and then receive literally a kickback in the form of dollars. And so there have been a number of bills through the legislature. The legislature is very much aware of this, and they've got other bills now requiring more treatment standards. For example, Senate Bill 325 would require outpatient programs, and this is not the residential treatment programs, but require outpatient programs to be licensed by the Department of Healthcare Services. And there are other bills that are out there that are trying to regulate the industry. And unfortunately, there's not a comprehensive omnibus bill that takes on all of these issues. It's hard to get legislation to work like that because of the laws already in place. But the lawmakers have identified it, and this is an issue that's frankly bipartisan. You'll see as many Republicans vote for it as the Democrats.
And my understanding is that the last year, the federal government, Congress, amazing anything got out of that chamber, actually passed something to this effect as well.
Yeah. It's called H.R. 6, also known as the Support Act, and this was probably the biggest addiction bill that we've seen in a long time. It required many changes as far as allowing for people to be treated for addiction within hospitals. That was something that was formerly excluded under Medicare and Medicaid. It allowed for the expansion of things like telemedicine. It required states to, or required essentially addiction treatment to come into the 21st century in many ways.
And is there any legislation that is looking at this idea when a rehab center owns sort of all the parts of production, so to speak, like the lab and the post-rehab that you go to and so on?
Yes. So there's I think it was the federal government in support, the Support Act, that banned patient brokering within the federal government. I'm not exactly positive on that. But suffice it to say, they're looking at, for example, with sober living environments, there's a bill up there right now. It's not the best bill, but it's a bill to look at this issue requiring licensure for the places with six or fewer patients within the sober living environments. So that may potentially require regulations for that as well. Because sober living environments is where a lot of people get care, meaning that they're in an environment where they get drug tested, they get inspected to make sure they're not bringing drugs in, and that's a lot of where treatment happens, these sober living environments, and there literally are no regulations on it at this point in time.
Mm. Dr. Lemke, would it be going out on a limb to say that the way that substance use has been vilified is maybe not the right word, but stigmatized, which then sort of led to all of this siloing of treatment. How much of that has led to the situation we're in, which is a whole treatment industry that is pretty much unregulated? I mean, did we drive it to this end?
Yes. I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head. The reason it's such a mess today is because for two centuries, we were not willing to include addiction in the house of medicine. We didn't recognize it as disease. It didn't grow up. It's been like the Cinderella of medicine for 200 years. And so as a result, you know, to meet the need, we have this sort of like hodgepodge, treatment offerings out there. And so now, you know, after the fact, we're trying to go out there and kind of clean it up, and it's a mess. So I think you're absolutely right. The reason that we're in the situation that we're in today is because we haven't acknowledged the disease of addiction, because we've stigmatized it, because we've marginalized this population. So out of desperation, you know, we have sort of this sort of huckster-esque opportunism that's resulted to try to meet the need for care.
So the question then comes to mind, if there's someone listening out there who has a loved one or are they themselves struggling with substance use, how do they know where to go to understand where they're going to get good care? Is there some sort of checklist out there? Is there something people should be looking for? What should people do?
Yeah, so...
One of the things that I sort of think is a good place to start, and it's not, you know, a fail-safe method, but it's a good place to start, is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, also known as SAMHSA, website or hotline. So they have a literally 24/7, 365 hotline that you can call. It's 1-800-662-HELP or 1-800-662-4357. where you can call and say, you know, I live in this zip code. I'm looking for substance use treatment for myself or my child or my spouse. And they will tell you, you know, what's in that area. And they have already done a little bit of vetting. Again, it doesn't mean you're guaranteed, you know, that it's going to be exactly right. But I think it's a really nice place to start, the SAMHSA online treatment locator.
And Dr. Khan, you were going to add something there?
Yeah, I was going to add that there are a couple of standards or accreditation or certifications you really want to look for. One of them is called CARF. The Committee on Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities. The other one is called the Joint Commission, and those should be prominently put on somebody's website if they are either CARF or Joint Commission certified. ASAM is working with CARF to create a separate and distinct certification, so you want to see that they're certified. When you interview the program, you want to ask, what is the presence of the physician or the role of somebody to manage care? You want to hear that they do have a physician on staff. Moreover, you want to know that they use medications specifically targeted to addiction, frankly, all addictions, opioids in particular, and alcohol. But you want to know that somebody has access to medications and will be able to remain on those medications throughout the duration of their stay in treatment and after the fact. And moreover, you want to understand questions about what type of outcomes are they getting? What are the results? And if you hear that we have a 98% success rate, run screaming. They're lying.
Dr. Sepla, what else would you tell people listening out there that they should be looking for if they're seeking drug treatment for themselves or a loved one?
Yeah, I usually end up having to tell people to start with a professional assessment. Get to someone who's a member of the American Society of Addiction Medicine that David's brought up in Anna. And then with their help or a psychologist who is also involved in addiction to seek a reputable place, they should be able to answer questions like, how do you personalize the care for our loved one? Do they have mental health services, both psychologists and psychiatrists? Detoxification, are they trauma-informed? Do they have a variable length of stay? This isn't just some sort of box you go in for 4 weeks and come out at the end of it, and multiple levels of care that it may start with residential, it may not, but then there's outpatient services that diminish over time as the individual starts to care for themselves. You don't want a place that actually takes insurance. A lot of the problems with some of the unscrupulous organizations that they don't take insurance as well. They just take private pay, and it adds to the difficulty. And again, as David described, the measured outcomes, hopefully published outcomes, someplace in a research journal.
Which might be really hard for the average person to try to figure out, right?
It's really hard. That's the trouble. I have people calling me all the time. In fact, 2 weeks ago, a mother called me, a friend of a friend, and they called after they admitted their daughter to a treatment program actually in the Bay Area. And she was there one night and said, this place is a Scientology place. And you know, the mother thought, well, you know, kids will say anything to get out of treatment. But it actually was. And so they got her out. And they admitted, they just went back online. That's how they found that place. Just went online, had this great description, and admitted her. And then they did the same thing the next night and brought her to another place, and I contacted her after the second admission, and they were so convinced of the second place as well. I have no idea where it was or what it was. But that, in the midst of chaos, in the midst of, you know, the difficulty in the family, when you're trying to make that decision, it's real easy to go astray and just go online and think you've found something great, and all the places look fantastic online.
And Dr. David Khan, you're going to get the last word here.
Yeah, and for families, the California Society of Addiction Medicine published a scorecard and a guide to families as to how to think about addiction treatment. It's available on the California Society of Addiction Medicine website, but this is a consumer-facing document that explains what is addiction treatment, what are the levels of care, and what should you be looking for when you're trying to pick, number one, an insurance plan, but number two, a treatment program as well.
Well, thanks for that, and we'll link that to our website. That's all the time we have for City Visions for this evening. I want to thank my guests, Dr. David Kahn, addiction psychiatrist, current president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine, and chief medical officer of Bright Heart Health, Dr. Anna Lemke, medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine, and Dr. Marvin Sepla, chief medical officer at Hazelden Betty Ford, and author of several books. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Join my co-host Ethan Elkind next Monday for a conversation with Bay Area native and author Vanessa Chua. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.